from KQED. Hey everyone from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos from KQED's politics team.
And I'm Katie Orr, KQED's Capitol reporter in today for Scott Schaefer.
Scott's out gallivanting. Today on The Breakdown, Tim Miller is in studio to talk about why on earth a Republican consultant would move from D.C. to Oakland and throw his lot in with the Pod Save America bros.
Yeah, and Tim will be with us in a moment, but first, let's talk news. The feud between California and Donald Trump continues, as it has for a while, and this time Governor Jerry Brown has not been able to lay low.
Yeah, he's been trying, but this latest dust-up is over the president's request for these four border state governors to deploy National Guard troops. The other three states, which happened to be red, all said yes, and Brown negotiated for a while, eventually agreed, but he said those troops will not there be building a wall.
Right, no wall.
And they will not be helping enforce immigration law. Mm-mm. And he also had some issue about how they were going to be paid for.
Yeah, he said, well, the federal government would typically pay for the deployment, but Trump wasn't happy about that and earned California a tweet. He tweeted today, Governor Jerry Brown announced he will deploy up to 400 National Guard troops to do nothing. The crime rate in California is high enough, and the federal government will not be paying for Governor Brown's charade. We need border security and action, not words.
I feel like we need like a kid in here.
I know. I don't know if my Trump reading abilities is that great. But the National Guard responded today. It said at approximately 11:30 p.m. AM today we received a written confirmation from the Pentagon that it will continue to fund the Cal National Guard, which they immediately followed up with this tweet. In short, nothing has changed today.
Which I kind of appreciated because every other tweet from them are like these like military sort of at 11:30 a.m. PDT. And yeah. They're like, dude, you guys, there's nothing to see here. So it seems like this is happening. The National Guard are going and they will not enforce immigration law, which it will be interesting to see. But on to another controversy, this one closer to home. This week, Democratic lawmakers killed the most talked about housing bill in recent memory. This was authored by San Francisco Senator Scott Wiener. SB 827 would have required cities to allow more high density development around transit corridors, and it had a lot of enemies.
Absolutely. And earlier today, we spoke with former journalist and venture capitalist Kim Mai Cutler, who supported the bill.
Kim, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start simple. Just tell us about Senate Bill 827 and what it would have done in your eyes.
827 was a very bold attempt to increase the minimum heights around transit stations from a quarter mile to half a mile to a minimum height of between 45 and 55 feet. And the whole purpose of that, you know, was to say California. Oh, there are about 500,000 Californians born a year. There are lots of migrants who move into the state from the rest of the country and the rest of the world. And this was an attempt to figure out ways that we could, you know, really increase the amount of housing being produced every year in the state. And the most logical place to put that housing is obviously near transit.
So what happened? I've been covering the Capitol for about 5 years now. Rarely do you see such a high-profile bill die so fast.
So fast.
And so hard.
And by Democrats, right?
Right. Yeah. What went wrong?
I mean, I think California historically has been very attached to a very car-centric, single-family home zone type of, architectural landscape. And it's just very hard to make that cultural and generational shift.
But what was interesting to me was what I might characterize as a bit of an unholy alliance opposing this bill, right? You had kind of some of the places you would expect, you know, cities in Marin and other counties that have really not been into high density, places like Beverly Hills. And then you had all of these like affordable housing advocates who seem to be making the argument that this could lead to more gentrification. I guess, first of all, why do you think those two groups found common ground here? And then what do you say to those arguments?
Yeah, well, first I would say that I wouldn't say that it's true that affordable housing advocates en masse opposed this bill. I would segment that out a little bit in a little bit more detail, which is, you know, the Nonprofit Housing Association of California was generally supportive of the bill. Like the entities that actually build the housing understand how difficult it is to get stuff financed. and approved and entitled and the whole thing. They understand how complicated and hard this is. They were generally supportive of it. And so I would segment that out from, you know, the collection of tenant activists who, you know, in parts of LA and some parts of San Francisco oppose this bill. And I think there's a set of issues there that, you know, people, these different constituencies and groups need to come to a shared vision or compromise on, which is, one, we need to figure out a way to protect tenants without impeding the creation of more housing as the population grows. And then the flip side of that is we need to encourage housing production without creating risks of displacement for tenants. And these two groups have historically been at odds. For so many years and so many decades in the Bay Area, and in particular the city of San Francisco. And, you know, the entities that always win in that situation are the existing property owners. And so, you know, as long as these two groups can't find a way to find that common vision or shared understanding, we're going to have, you know, a situation that continues to spiral out of control.
I'm curious, though, if you feel like, was the problem here the policy, or was it the politics in the sense of, like, could Scott Wiener have rolled this out in a better way? Could this have been approached in a more sort of collaborative manner that would have at least chipped away at some of that opposition?
So I think the judgment of the particular strategy that he rolled this out in should probably be reserved until next year. I would say if it was judged, obviously, on a one-year timeline, then obviously this was not the correct strategy to use.
But legislation can take a while.
Right. So, like, on a one-year time frame, you know, what he did was he announced this bill in a very this idea or this concept in a very purist sense, and then subsequently added in amendments later. Amendments that, you know, he had kind of channeled to other supporters that he was going to add from the very beginning. But I do think that made it hard from a strategic perspective to, you know, at least initially talk about the bill, because it didn't have all of those anti-demolition and tenant protections baked in, which he later did add.
So I guess the question just is, then, like, what happens now? We've been told over and over that we need a big radical change in the way California thinks if we're ever going to tackle the massive housing problem. This seemed to be an attempt at that. It failed pretty spectacularly in its
first go-around.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, I mean, where do we go from here?
It provoked a very broad and deep conversation about, you know, what hard choices we want to make as a state. I think there's also a lot of really interesting and bold ideas also coming down the pipeline in terms of, you know, Costa-Hawkins reform or repeal for tenants, and then also changing Proposition 13 protections for commercial or office properties. So there's a lot of different bold ideas in the mix. It's just a matter of, like, again, how do we have that conversation about, okay, we need to build more, right, to match the population growth and immigration flows that we are having. And we also need to protect tenants. And we also need to make sure that there's sufficient housing set aside and protected for, you know, middle and lower income residents of California.
Kim, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we will be joined by Republican strategist and opposition researcher Tim Miller. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos, along with guest host Katie Orr, who's in for Scott Schaefer.
And here with us in the studio tonight is Tim Miller. He worked for Jeb Bush's presidential bid and remains a never-Trumper. Welcome to the program, Tim.
Hey, good to be with you all.
Is that all true? Everything
that is all so far.
So far.
I'll be fact-checking you along the way.
Okay, good. Yeah, we want to hear that. So actually, it's funny because, you know, we like to get a little bit behind the scenes with our guests, talk about, like, what brought them to where they are in their careers. There's, like, no information about you online other than, like, your career stuff. It's like you didn't exist before you graduated from GW.
Well, as an opposition researcher, you know, it's important to have a good handle on your online content.
So you figured out how to scrub all the stuff that everyone else is having collected on them, basically.
Could be. Or it's buried in my Twitter feed. I just tweet so much. There's so much content about me on Twitter that it buries everything else.
We should have had an algorithm.
Yeah.
So where'd you grow up?
Denver.
And you went to GW.
I did go to GW, and I was, just like, I'm a very rare Republican in Oakland. I was a very rare Republican at the George Washington University.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And I interned for the Republican Governors Association while I was there. Bill Owens was the governor of Colorado when I was growing up, and I had interned for him, and then he ran the Republican Governors Association and at the time. And so it was basically from there that I blossomed and was a political gypsy for a while.
And were your parents Republicans? Like, did you grow up in a political family?
Not really. I mean, yeah, my dad was a Republican. My mom has been, you know, one of those vaunted swing voters until I became a political activist. And then, you know, she fell in line. And then obviously, as these things go, the converts are always radicalized. She went farther than I was ever able to go
in
conservatism.
Trump?
She did not. Okay. She did not vote for Trump. I think she voted for Pope Francis. I believe she wrote in Pope Francis. I don't know if I should be telling. I don't know if she'll be happy that I'm telling that on the internet.
Don't worry, we don't know her name.
I'm keeping all my things secret, but I'm giving her all my mom's secrets.
What was it about the Republican Party conservatism that appeals to you?
Well, that's a big question. You know, I think it was you know, a sense of the individual freedoms that come from the Republican Party. I mean, I always had sort of a libertarian bent to the party and was always, you know, kind of attracted to, and I think this will be prelude to my distaste for Trump, but prelude to kind of, you know, the shining city on the hill type of republicanism. I remember, you know, I was pretty young during that Elian Gonzalez, you know, was it a crisis, scandal? What word would
I don't, yeah, I mean, that seems
it?
So quaint
events?
Right now.
Yeah,
but
it seems extremely quaint right now. But right, I remember at the time really connecting with that and being mad at the Clinton administration. Like, why wouldn't you know, sort of let somebody into the country that was, you know, coming to find freedom in our country?
Although that could probably be flipped these days.
Oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely. It absolutely could. And I think that's what I was saying. I think that is sort of prelude to my, you know, distaste for the way that the party has turned. So I think I was attracted to those things. I mean, my dad, it's sort of cliche. I hate to use cliches. My dad was sort of an up from your bootstraps person. So I think that all kind of appealed to me. You know, the in government, you know, kind of being a rebellious youngster. A lot of times, and I think this has manifested itself in bad ways recently. You know, people think about rebellious kids being, you know, Democrats, right? You know, but in some ways, in sort of privileged communities, it's kind of rebellious to be a Republican. It's kind of rebellious
to be a
Republican.
Yeah, like I went to youth group.
Yeah,
to, like,
you know, against the government, against the man. So I had kind of an element of that, I think.
Okay, well, that brings me to something. So I was, as we were reading up on you, yep. Among the words I saw used to describe you were knife fighter, pugilistic. I'm just wondering. Also, to be fair, they talked about digitally fluent and social media savvy. But, like, what do you think that those descriptions come from? You seem like such a nice guy, Tim.
Well, I've softened in my old
You're
age.
You're a dad
yeah,
now.
Yeah, I'm a dad now. I'm kind of like John Boehner. I'm starting to cry a lot.
You're
more.
You're going to work for the cannabis industry.
Yeah, I'm going to work for the cannabis industry soon. So I have to admit that I've softened. You know, I think it's just because of you know, probably the aggressive nature in which, you know, I fought campaigns. And I came from opposition research world. So anybody, I think, who does opposition research is automatically tagged as being, you know, a knife fighter or somebody who's shadowy and behind the scenes. I started the biggest opposition group research group in the Republican Party back in 2012. You know, that's now,
when you were like
now,
6 years
yeah,
old.
called America Rising, which I've since left, but, you know, other folks are still running it and it's still the largest one in the party. And, you know, by nature, if you're running the largest opposition research organization, you're going to spend a lot of time criticizing people in a, you know, sometimes in a biting or nasty way. And so I certainly was guilty of that from time to time. I think that's why I was tagged with those descriptions. Twitter feed is also pretty biting.
Oh, yeah, we need to get into that. But
I want to get into the opposition research. Like, yeah. So I can Google stuff, right? But, like,
sure.
How do you even go about the process of beginning to discover opposition research on whoever you are looking
into?
Talk
us through what is opposition research?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people, and in certain ways this serves us, so we sort of let this reputation exist, but people's imaginations run wild about what opposition research is.
I watched
right?
Scandal.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
I know what they do.
You know, you're diving into dumpsters or, you know, your brown paper bags and in front of the Lincoln Monument at 3 o'clock in the morning. We didn't really do a whole lot of that.
All right. Fine.
You know,
first our bubble.
Mostly, yeah, I know, sorry. Mostly what it is You know, going through the public record, our opposition researchers at where the firm I went to after America Rising was Definers would have done a much better job than you did right there of finding information
about
my childhood.
They probably would have spent a little bit more time.
You know, so a lot of it is just full information awareness. A lot of it is, and you know, that means going through video, the YouTube archives. I mean, the most famous. I can now reveal our secrets. You know, opposition research hit that we got at America Rising was we basically ruined the Senate candidate of Bruce Braley, who's running for Senate in Iowa, because of a video of him in Texas where he's talking to a bunch of lawyers and he was making fun of farmers, which, you know,
not a good idea.
Doesn't go over very well in Iowa. And it was in a really kind of nasty way. And he's standing in front of liquor bottles and it just looked horrible. And, you know,
was that just on YouTube?
Yeah. So people were wondering, like, did you have a mole in the room? And we kind of let that image head out there. But all that really happened was one of the lawyers in the audience was videotaping it and posted it to his own Facebook page because, you know, he thought it was cool. Like that he was, hey, I was in this room with this guy running for Senate. And like, here's a little bit of what he said. And you know, we saw it and the guy took it down, obviously, when he saw the ads and stuff. So nobody could find out where we had sourced it. So, you know, a lot of it is as simple as that. There is records gathering going to.
Yeah, it's like old school.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of that, you know, the old paper gathering is your competitive advantage now, right? Everybody has Google. So having the resources to go to courthouses, libraries, you know, when we were doing, the America Rising, which was the group that I started, was the first group targeting Hillary Clinton in front of 2016. And then fast forward, and I then worked for the Super PAC against Donald Trump. So I think I have a unique qualification of being the only person who worked for Super PACs against both of the nominees in 2016. But, you know, we went down to the Clinton Library in 2012 and, you know, uncovered some of the
their
audio.
Own stuff, yeah. Against them.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Old writings, you know, that she, you know, had done.
Do you ever worry about, like, if you're in a primary, like, you don't want to dirty up, like you want your candidate to win, but do you worry about if it's another Republican they're running against, you don't want to dirty him up too much, or is this just, like, mercenary work?
Honestly, family feuds are always the most fun the nastiest. You know, in some ways, like, the Republican on Democratic fights are a little bit predictable, right?
Yeah.
The fault lines are. Whereas in primaries, sometimes it's predictable, but other times, you know, especially if their policy positions are aligned, which wasn't the case in 2016, but was in many of the other primaries, you know, the attacks, you know, you have to be a little more creative. So a lot of times it was more fun, honestly, to do the opposition research in the primaries. My regret, I do have. Well, it's getting kind of deep. I do have sort of regret about the whole thing, you know, to be honest, because I think that the tone of our politics has just devolved in such a way that I kind of felt like at some point that it was in good hands with the opposition researchers, right? Like, we were choosing, you know, what was an appropriate attack and what was not, and like the gatekeepers have totally broken down now, and now I have some
trains off the rails,
you know,
a little
yeah
bit.
The trains are totally off the tracks, and I sort of have some regrets about the, you know, the nature of our attacks. But in the most specific, I was against Mitt in two primaries, because I was McCain in 08 and then Huntsman in 12, and leveled and came up with some pretty aggressive attacks against him. And so there was a little bit of that family regret in the end, because I ended up liking Mitt a whole lot, and he grew on me quite a bit. And so,
well, it's like
it hurt
easier.
Me to hear the Obama people using my stuff in 2012. I was like,
well, it's always easier, like, when you think of yourself on teams, to be really nasty, and then you, like, actually talk to someone. I mean, we know this from covering politics, right?
Yeah.
You're like, oh, that guy. And then you get to know him, and you're like, he's nice. A perfectly nice person.
Well, so opposition research. Why didn't it work against Donald Trump? I mean, there's so much out there. There's so much that we know. Why is he different? Why didn't it stick?
That's a really good question. There are a couple of reasons. One was it did with certain audiences, just not the right ones, right? I mean, I briefed the Democrat after Trump won the nomination. I went to brief the Democratic super PACs, Hillary super PACs going against him, because, you know, we'd been in the fights. And what I said to them at the time was, we know what works against women. You know, we know what works to make women not like Donald Trump. You didn't have to do much, frankly.
Right.
Just his personal being was pretty repulsive. But, you know, we know it works with Hispanic audiences, with millennials. white working class men. We don't know what works. Huh. And there were some, and I told it was like Rumsfeld. I said, there are some known knowns. We know it doesn't work, right? Like, they don't care about his gaffes and his mean comments, right?
Although white women did go for him pretty strongly,
they,
too.
They did. But ex-urban, mostly. Right. Suburban women, not as much. But we didn't know what would work with them, and I think we still don't know. I don't think that any in the primary or the general, anybody did a very good job of talking about the way he screwed over working class people, which he did time and time again. Small business owners, construction guys, the Trump University people, there's a whole litany of them. Not a lot of focus was on that, so I think that could have been some mistake on the campaign. And I think another mistake was Trump's brand sort of overshadowed all of that. Like he was uniquely shameless, in the sense that he was like, yeah, that's right. A lot of those things that they're saying about me, I did, right? And I don't care.
Like,
it's
it
good.
Takes
it's,
some wind out
right,
of the sails.
It's
sale.
Good, it's right. good that oh, I did them. Right. Screw those people, right? So he did that mm-hmm. in a lot of cases. And then in other cases, he was uniquely shameless in saying, that's not true. That's a lie, when things were true. And his voters either believed that or suspended disbelief.
You said you went and briefed the Democrats after he won the nomination. Is that unusual for you?
Extremely unusual.
I mean, I just want to make that clear.
Yeah, extremely unusual. Yeah, I didn't. It wasn't my idea. They asked me, and I thought I said no at first, and then I think I replied back and I said, "Well, yeah, of course I will. Actually, why would I say no?" It was. I mean, I still think that Trump is uniquely dangerous. I didn't like Hillary at all. I did end up voting for her in the end. I changed my mind at the last kind of minute and decided to vote for her. I was planning on voting for, Gary Johnson or whatever. Because I think Trump is so uniquely dangerous, I still believe that.
Like, to democracy, not just to the Republican Party or to America?
Both, all. I mean, I think that if you look at things, probabilistically, right, like the... not to get too dorky, but like the long tail risks of like the worst possible things that could happen with Trump are really, really bad, right? And maybe those won't happen. Maybe they'll never happen. Maybe he'll be contained by his staff and by his desire to be loved and by the courts and, various things. But, I thought that the negatives of Hillary were kind of well known, right? And
Status quo.
Right, it's status mm-hmm. quo negative. And the risks of Trump were far greater. So for that reason, and just, his personal character.
So you also got a lot of attention, let's say, when you announced that you were supporting Doug Jones, the Alabama Senate candidate, over, as you put it in a post on Pod Save America's website, Crooked Media, a child molester. And you're kind of known as Pod Save America's like token Republican. They've had you on since, I think, Keeping It 1600, right? Like back when those guys were in
the
White House.
Yeah, the first token Republican, yeah.
And I saw you talk about at one point, like you got a lot of liberal social media followers out of the Never Trump, and then they like turn on you when your true conservative colors come out. I'm just curious, like what it's been
like. I like tweeting
about
tax cuts every once in a while just to see the replies.
Just to like
it,
yeah.
Just to see
and now you're in California.
I know. Well, just really quick on the Doug Jones thing, it was one of the most bizarre experiences of my life. And then National NPR did an interview with me. They sent someone to Oakland, and the producer was really confused that there was a Republican living in West Oakland. But she was like, she had a lot of questions for me. And I, when they called me to do the interview, I was like, really? I didn't even think it was noteworthy. I posted it on Facebook because I was mad about Trump supporting more. And the RNC supporting more. I used to work for the RNC, and I just wanted to say simply to my followers that I used to work for the RNC. I think this is sick. Like, this is a depraved person, between his child molestation and his radical position. So you went to jail, gays, in a list of other things. And so I'm going to vote. It's not enough to just say they both are bad. I'm going to donate to his opponent. And that garnered a lot of interest. And I think that that's sad that that's where we are in the country, that we're so polarized and partisan, that like opposing your own team because they nominated a child molester
it's
is like noteworthy
news.
Now and big and viral. So yes, I did. I did a bunch of liberal interviews at MSNBC and NPR, and the pod guys I did a couple times, Pod Save America. And yes, so now I do have a lot of liberal followers with that have strange new respect for me. They got really mad when I talked about how much I like Kevin Williamson, who just got fired from The Atlantic for his pro-life views. And they get mad at me when I tweet about tax cuts. So every once in a while, after I do a bunch of anti-Trump tweets, I like to needle them and kind of remind my followers that I haven't completely abandoned the team here. Like, I am still a small government conservative.
Well, and you have a relationship with the Bush family. You worked for yep. Jeb Bush. You knew Barbara Bush.
I did.
Tell us a little bit about her. What are
like speaking of civility?
Yeah,
right?
And yeah. your impressions. Why do you think she will be missed by those who really loved her?
Do we need people like Barbara Bush right now? And it's really the two things that are the most painful about it for me is one, I just feel so bad for President Bush 41, who you know has been sick for a long time, and just
they
on
a really
personal level,
love story.
Yeah, 73 years they wrote each other love letters. You know, that'll just make you cry if you go listen to some of their interviews they've done about them, and. You know, it was almost, not to be macabre, but kind of planning, like, he was going to die for a while now, you know? And so for now, for him to be alone, I think that's really painful on a personal level, though he sent a hilarious tweet yesterday that where he said it was basically, get the Bushes off your worry list. Barbara lived a great life. And so,
you tweeted a picture of being on the campaign with,
yeah.
with Barbara Bush taking photos of Jeb Bush being swarmed by the media.
Yeah, and she was so cute. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I got to spend probably a week with her on the campaign trail where she went with us from New Hampshire to South Carolina. And she was just marvelous. My favorite story from her is we were about to sit down to do a Nora O'Donnell interview. And I had to brief her. And this was kind of nervous. You know, I got to meet her a little bit, but to like actually brief Barbara Bush on what to say. And I said, okay, you know, you're going to get asked about Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. And so let's talk about what you're going to say. And she just laced into Trump and Cruz and how little she trusts them and da da da. And then at the end of it all, she looks at me and she says, but I'm not going to say that.
But she did say some of that.
She basically said that she doesn't understand how women could vote for him, which I think is would have been a fair point. And I think that goes to the point, right? She was mad at Trump in particular for his language and the way he treated women. And she just had this abiding respect for civility and decency. You know where she stood. She told it like it was. She wasn't afraid to, you know, poke you. But she also just was such a good and decent person. There's this great Atlantic article about a guy who said that at age 90, they had a lunch together and he changed her view on transgender policy. And she was her grandson, Jeb Jr., who I'm friends with, said that the best way to honor her is to read to kids because literacy is so important to her and to look at a view that's not your own because that's what she was all about.
We are going to end on that. Tim Miller, thanks so much for coming in. This
thanks,
was
y'all.
Fun.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That does it for this edition of Political Breakdown. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts.
Our producer is Guy Marzorati. Our engineer is Seal Muller. Ethan Lindsay is our managing editor, and Holly Kernan is our vice president of news. I'm Katie Orr, here for Scott Schaefer. Follow me on Twitter at @1KatieOrr.
I'm Marisa Lagos. I'll be back next week with a hopefully tan and relaxed Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. It's @MLagos. That's a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown. We'll see you next week.